When we go about our daily business of living, turning on lights and buying food and throwing things away, we're unlikely to think about the people whose work goes into making these things available. After Jean Marie Laskus, formerly of The Washington Post, now a correspondent for GQ, investigated the lives of coal miners for an article, she became fascinated with the whole notion of the people behind the scenes. And that led to her latest book, Hidden America, From Coal Miners to Cowboys, An Extraordinary Exploration of the Unseen People Who Make This Country Work. It's published by Putnam. I'm very pleased that it brings Jean Marie Laskus to our show today. Hello.
Hi there.
What got you interested at first in investigating the lives of coal miners?
Well, I live in Western Pennsylvania. We have coal miners, you know, probably in my backyard. And I started wondering, how come I don't know them? How are these my neighbors and I don't even know what they do? And I found a group that would let me come inside a coal mine.
And that was in Ohio, that your neighbors wouldn't let you in?
No, the close neighbors would not. But I found a coal mine in Ohio and spent quite a bit of time underground with these guys.
And what I imagine is dark, depressing. What did you find?
Okay, dark, yes. The only light from your hard hat. However, it's white. It's all white. That so freaked me out. I said, what are you talking about? It's white down here. Is this irony?
And you mean the walls are white?
The walls are white. Because after you dig the coal, you've got to throw what's called rock dust on it to keep it from it being explosive. So that's how they sort of neutralize the explosion. So when you travel down these, you know, it's all white. And low, 5 feet high, everyone leaned over doing a duck walk. And the scary part is not so much the down, which you think it will be, 500 feet down, straight down an elevator, but in, you know, because then once you're down, you hop on this train and go in for like 45 minutes under the earth. That was the scary part to me.
Was it your sense that these coal miners liked what they did? They enjoyed their work?
There was a love-hate certainly with that work. We're grateful for that work. That work paid them well, about 70 grand a year, and enabled them to hang on to their farms above ground. That's what mattered to them. There were no other jobs in Appalachia in general. So those coal mines opening in Appalachia meant those people could keep their land.
So they really had two jobs.
Yes, that's the thing. You know, coal 10-hour shifts in the mine, typically. And then after that, it's home to, you know, bale some hay, you know, take care of the cows.
Well, it's a very dangerous profession. Did they ever talk about that?
Oh, yes, extremely. I mean, that was one of the things I write about in there is how comfortable everyone there is with death. Everyone had a friend who was crushed or the roof fell on their father, and it was just what happened. And it was more like combat soldiers almost, very extremely dangerous.
At what point in writing the article for GQ did you start thinking about investigating other professions that we might consider undervalued?
I think it was when one of the coal miners said to me, you know, every single time you flip on a light switch, you burn a lump of coal. I'd never thought of it at that sort of connected to my life, you know, something as sort of esoteric as coal. But I realized, you know, okay, we're all really connected, you know, every day intimately to what a coal miner does. So I started wondering, what other industries are we that connected to?
And when you start making up lists, you discover there are lots of hidden professions.
It's crazy.
A lot more than you could cover in this book.
Once you start thinking about it, it just multiplies. I had to think, what am I not going to write about? I mean,
so are you going to do another book, Son of Hidden America?
Son of Hidden America. We'll see. I certainly talking to enough people with interesting jobs these days that I could easily do another one.
Did you research any hidden professions that you just couldn't include in the book?
I had some that I wanted to get to that I still have not. Shipping ports, difficult to get on the borders there on those import and export. I thought that would be really interesting to see, talk to those people right on the edge of America in that way, you know, of consumer. I wanted to hang out with some people building a building up high, you know, erecting those tall buildings, the people who spend their days up on top of a skyscraper. Haven't done that one yet.
Well, you might have to go up yourself. You did talk about, you did go to investigate the lives of migrant farm workers. We usually associate them with Florida and oranges, but you spoke to someone who are harvesting blueberries in Maine. What is the harvesting culture like up there?
Oh, that was so fascinating. The migrant streams, at least the way that it used to be structured, but still in some ways, is you work your way up, you work your way north with, you know, the ripening crops. And the top of it is Maine at blueberry season. It pays
so
the best.
So they start with oranges and then maybe tomatoes somewhere in the mid-Atlantic and then
lettuce,
blueberries up there.
Peaches, up until, you know, blueberry season, which is kind of like the best. It's like the highest paying.
But why is it the highest paying? Is that why blueberries cost so much?
Well, I don't know why it's the highest paying. It just traditionally always has been. It's, you know, it's all hard work, no matter who's doing the picking of various, you know, in agriculture. But that one was very difficult. And I think that those people, that was a difficult world to sit in for very long because, you know, then you leave and you go to a restaurant and have a salad and you say, wait a second, I just never thought about who brought me this, who's out there picking this stuff.
It also is a real skill. I know I've picked blueberries at, you know, wild blueberries, whatever. A friend's had a blueberry patch. You don't get a lot of blueberries after doing a lot of work. These people have to pick a lot of blueberries in a very brief time.
Oh, in very hard conditions, too. It's hot. Yeah, you're raking. They have these giant rakes, and each person had a rake that they had made themselves that sort of fit to their own body, the right height. And you just rake with getting a rhythm, and it goes to the beat of the music coming out of the trucks. And it's really quite beautiful to a visitor's eye. But to them, you know, that's some really difficult work.
You spoke with one worker in particular, Urbano, who was actually a homeowner. And he was picking blueberries to pick up the economic slack for the moment.
Yeah.
So some of these people don't do it all the time?
No. They would hop aboard. He needed he was losing his house, and he needed to make as much money as he could. And his sons agreed. They were 14. They agreed to come in the car with him and come on up north.
Many people associate the narratives of migrant farm workers with illegal immigrants. The conversation doesn't start or end with Mexican and other Latin American immigrants. What are other immigrant populations who are harvesting the blueberries in Maine?
Well, in Maine, I will tell you, it could have been every Mexican and other South American countries was the bulk of of the population there.
Was there a concern among some of them that they didn't have their papers?
Oh, absolutely. Most of them, many of them did not. And they would very willingly show me their fake papers, fake IDs, fake everything fake. And, you know, it wasn't like, oh, we're proud of this at all. It was they were ashamed and they were hidden on purpose and didn't want to be.
Were they, most of them, people who would have preferred to be able to assimilate as earlier waves of immigrants have? Or do you think that they wanted to return to their home countries after they'd made some money?
I was surprised how often I heard the story that they wanted to return home. The tighter border patrol meant to them difficult to go home because they know getting back would be so difficult. But they wanted to go home to their villages. That story surprised me how often that came.
My guest is Jean Marie Laskus. Her book, Hidden America, From Coal Miners to Cowboys, An Extraordinary Exploration of the Unseen People Who Make This Country Work. It's published by Putnam. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. Later on in the show, Salman Rushdie talks about his life in the years after the Ayatollah Khomeini issued a fatwa in 1989 calling for his death. And I'd like to announce the next pick of the Leonard Lopate Show Book Club. This month, we're reading David Mitchell's novel, Cloud Reader. The story is told through six different narratives, each with its own time, style, and place. Start reading and then tune in on October 17th when David Mitchell answers your questions about Cloud Reader. For more information, visit our show page at WNYC.org. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.
WNYC receives support from The Club at Briarcliff Manor, a new retirement community under development in Westchester, offering Hudson River views and a variety of home styles and financial options. Info center and model residences open daily. 914-923-4050. Roundabout Theater Company, presenting a new production of Cyrano de Bergerac. Douglas Hodge stars as Cyrano, the nobleman with a tremendous wit and an enormous nose, now playing at the American Airlines Theater. Tickets at roundabouttheater.org. WNYC is a media partner for Go Green NYC, a business conference with a network of green-minded professionals to empower decision-makers with sustainability strategies, tools, and connections. Wednesday, September 19th at the Time Center. Details at newyork.gogreenconference.net.
Hi, this is Jonathan Schwartz. Now you can hear the great music of the American Songbook night and day. On Saturdays, I'll be on right after a Prairie Home Companion at 8 o'clock in the evening. You can still hear the Sunday program as usual at 12 noon. See WNYC's new weekend schedules online at WNYC.org.
We're back with Jean Marie Laskus, who's a correspondent for GQ. She wrote a story about coal miners. It was a finalist for the National Magazine Awards, and that has led to her look at other hidden jobs in America. Her book is called Hidden America, From Coal Miners to Cowboys, An Extraordinary Exploration of the Unseen People Who Make This Country Work. It's published by Putnam. I'm surprised that now I'm going to talk about a group of NFL cheerleaders. They're not hidden at all. In fact, their bodies are barely hidden.
That's what we think. That chapter is an effort to look at the culture of celebrity in America. Obviously not head on, because that's not consistent with the goals that I have, but from the periphery. Who are the people on the periphery of that, you know, sort of largest spectacle we've got in an NFL stadium, and literally the sidelines. Who do we have there? Cheerleaders, who we think are all, perhaps we think, are all about maybe fame and fortune, and maybe finding a nice NFL husband or something like that. But in fact, you know, those women, do you know how much they make per game?
I'm scared to ask.
$75.
So they're doing it for the glory of being out there in the cold in very little clothing. Even though they are quite visible, in a way they are hidden, because you don't really distinguish one from the other.
No, they're the goal in some ways is for them is to actually look alike, you know, exact same lipstick, exact same outfits, exact same hair. Similar height, similar look, and sort of they flash before our eyes, and we don't even think of them as people at all. And boy, some of the folks I got to know, Adrian is like the main character in that story. You know, she poured the cement at Paul Brown Stadium. She was a cement worker, and she was being named cheerleader of the week, the hugest success of her life.
The group is called the Bengal Gals, because it's the Bengals. The Bengals. You say that professional cheerleaders embody the characteristics America most loves and hates about itself. What do you mean by that?
Well, we love our optimism. We love our spirit of, you know, nationalism, and we hate that we're shallow and foolish. They are all of that in one package.
Is it the same in all the NFL cities? The cowboy cheerleaders have become a brand, haven't they?
I think the cowboy cheerleaders have sort of their own level of respect. That's kind of the top of the pyramid, if you will. But the rest of them are they weren't about succeeding on that level, though.
But they just felt it was a kind of personal stardom.
Oh, absolutely. Since they were grown up in their towns, you know, it was, I'm going to be a Bengal. I mean, when I kept saying, why do you want to do this? I mean, it's hard work. The level of discipline. You talk about soldiers. Why? For $75 a game, all this hard work? And it was just like they couldn't even understand that question. It was, I'm a Bengal.
On the other hand, you spent time in the air traffic control tower at LaGuardia, where money has been an issue. I was impressed that you were able to even get in there. Is it difficult to get permission?
Oh, that took about a year, talking with the FAA and going between the FAA and the union. Finally, the FAA allowed me into there.
You quote one of the controllers as saying that the more invisible he is, the better he's doing his job.
Exactly. You know, I think there's this narrative in America that everybody wants to be rich and famous. And one message that I get from this book, I'll tell you, some people are the absolute opposite of that goal. You know, you don't want – controllers don't want to be known. If they're known, it means they just really messed up and perhaps people are dead. They love being invisible.
Interestingly, we expect this kind of work to be high tech, but it turns out it really isn't the case for air traffic controllers.
We're talking analog. You know,
And why is that? I would think that my car with the GPS is fairly sophisticated and not analog.
Well, I will say, of course, there's sophisticated equipment available to them. And don't you know, I said foolish things like, hey, you guys, there are computers who could do this for you. but in fact, you know, the memory, the need for them to remember where everything is at every moment, they need every cue they can have. And tactile cues are one such cue. And so they had, you know, actual things they could touch on the control board that told them where a plane was at any given moment at the gate, ready for takeoff, et cetera.
There seems to be a lot of tension between the management and the union in this profession. Does that date back to when President Reagan broke the air traffic controller union?
It sure does. Yeah, and the numbers of controllers, the FAA has not been hiring, and that is now felt because there's also a mandatory retirement age. They're retiring right and left. The middle age group is not filled, so they're hiring people off you know, the streets now.
Why is it so difficult to find people to fill these jobs? Because it's just so high pressure.
It's now that the job, any time that they have a time where they have jobs opened, they need lots of bodies. It takes a long period of time to train. So, you know, you've got to be in the pipeline headed up to become a fully trained controller. And that the pipeline has been empty for a while.
Some of the other people, we don't have a lot of time, and I want to touch on some of these other jobs. Gun shops aren't all that common in New York, but that's not the case in most cities. Why do you consider gun shop clerks to be hidden people?
I wanted to know who are the people right there at the front line making the decisions who gets a gun and who doesn't. You know, the Tucson shooter was turned down at a Walmart in Arizona. He wasn't allowed to buy ammunition by a clerk at Walmart. Who is that person? How did you get to say no? I don't trust this guy. And do other clerks say no?
Obviously not.
I stayed at a store, a really beautiful store, where I was sort of working at the counter with the gun dealers and finding how personal a choice that is, you know, a decision rather. And that's a fairly controversial point to make, but it is a fact.
And then you also joined workers on an oil rig on a remote Alaskan island, probably the most extreme example of a group that's unseen in America. And it must have been, how cold was it up there?
When I got there, it was minus 45.
Do they feel that they are separate from the rest of the country?
Oh, sure. However, you know, there's a case where they live in, you know, darkness. There wasn't any sun when I was there in February. And 2 weeks at a time minimum, usually many of them for a month at a time. And I sort of thought, what is the matter with you people? How did you get stuck here? But in fact, that was the most naive question I could have asked. They said to me, you know what? We choose to be here. We're not in prison. We choose to be here.
Although they do go into cages, polar bear cages.
Yeah. I said, why do you put the polar bears in cages? No. The cages are for you. You see a polar bear, you run in the cage.
You also rode along with a trucker named Sputter, a woman. Are we seeing more women driving trucks these days?
I think we are seeing more women now, but it is still a bit rare. And She here was an example of a trucker who loved being a trucker. She had wanted to be a trucker since she was a little girl, and now she works out of Cleveland, long hauling.
And you were surprised that there are a lot of jobs to be filled in the trucking industry as well.
Trucking industry, you know, you talk about jobs in this economy. What are we going to do? Well, one thing we can do is all go be truckers. They need them desperately.
So air traffic controller or trucker.
Yes, these are jobs.
You also visited a landfill, which by definition is something people don't want to see, garbage. What makes the Puente Hills landfill in California the landfill to visit if you're visiting a landfill?
Oh, listen, the title of that chapter is This is Paradise for a reason. You know, the last place we even want to think about is a landfill. We sort of blame the landfill even for being there, forgetting that it's our trash, that it's actually being taken care of. But that landfill in Puente Hills in Los Angeles had, you know, the engineers of that landfill had solved so many problems of our trash, and they were rightfully proud of it.
What kinds of problems?
Well, we think about, you know, energy, the methane gas coming out of a landfill converted to energy, fueling whole neighborhoods in Los Angeles. This is extraordinary to me that technology, was developed in my lifetime, and it's working. And that was developed there. Lots of those sorts of breakthroughs happened at that landfill, and they were proud of it.
So they were happy to be garbage bin, in effect.
You know, it trickled from – it was from the engineers down to the Herman, the guy who hauled the trash in. They were proud of their landfill.
Jean Marie Laskus will be speaking at the Powerhouse Arena. That's at 37 Main Street in Brooklyn. It's 7 o'clock on Wednesday the 26th. That's a week from tomorrow. Her book is called Hidden America, From Coal Miners to Cowboys. We never got to the cowboys, but, I'll go see a Western tonight, catch up on that. An exploration of the unseen people who make this country work. It is published by Putnam. And I want to thank you so much for being on our show today. It's been a lot of fun. And I would look forward to a second Hidden America.
Oh, my pleasure.
Okay.
Thank you.